Responsibility is a word that comes up a lot in art, but its meaning is as multifaceted as the artists who use it. It can mean duty of care to your fellow practitioners, responsibility to deliver the product the subscribers are paying for, or not to traumatise the audience who didn't consent to be traumatised, but it can also mean responsibility to be brave. Brave enough to tell the hard stories, to press on wounds that need pressing. Sometimes the old adage that art holds a mirror up to society is far too passive. Sometimes that mirror needs smashing. In this, the second season of Audio Stage, we're talking responsibility in art. We'll be in dialogue with various practitioners, programmers, and thinkers about what responsibility means to them and how we remain ethical in art. I'm Fleur Kilpatrick, and today I'm without my co-host, Jana, but that's okay because I'm an independent woman. So today I am joined in the studio by two beautiful, generous artists, Jolyon James and Sonia Suarez, to talk responsibility in art. This episode, we're talking about the role of the actor and their responsibility with their craft, and the director's responsibility to the actor, and what it means to transition from actor to various other roles within the theatrical world. We don't always read everyone's bios in full, but I think that with you two, it's kind of will give us a framework.
No, you're not going to do that.
I won't. I'll abridge by saying it's actually kind of interesting.
Sure, absolutely. Let's do that.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you two, that just by lucky happenstance, you guys have some similarities in your bios, that you both came through Whopper as actors.
That's right. That's
you've both done a multitude of TV, film, stage. You've both done a lot of musicals.
Happened.
But then I'll give a bit of a framework as well. So Sonia was general manager of Red Stitch from 2009 to 2012 before becoming the artistic coordinator of Monash Academy of Performing Arts. She's founder of independent theatre company Watch This, which produces and performs musicals, for which they've won a whole bunch of Green Room nominations. She was recently co-created and performed Elbow Room's highly acclaimed We Get It as part of 2015 MTC Neon Festival. And in September, she'll be opening company with Watch This, and in November, delivering the inaugural Poppy Seed Festival program. Jolyon James is currently the associate artist at Arena Theatre Company, has been artistically involved in the development and realisation of works at that company throughout 2014 and 2015, most recently with Marlin at MTC, the Marlin Expedition through the Arts Centre Melbourne, POV and Cautionary Tales for Children. Yeah, and you're also a photographer, a finalist in the National Portrait Prize in 2012.
That's so, right.
Hi, welcome both of you.
Hi, Fleur.
Hi. Let's start with you guys as actors before we move on to you guys as all the many, many other roles that you also are. So what does responsibility mean within your practice as an actor? What do you view as the responsibility of the actor?
God, that's a good question, isn't it?
It's a great question.
I suppose at a really kind of intimate level, my first instinct is to say that the responsibility is to be honest and really brave, because I think sometimes what I like to call them civilians will say to you, "Oh, you're an actor. You must be really good at lying." And I'm not. I'm actually dreadful. I have no poker face. I'm terrible. And I'm like, you know, so you should hit me up for a game of poker. I'm also shit at poker. So I'll put that out there. But when we use the words to describe amazing performances, we use words like truthful and honest, because we see in the artist them bearing something, them having made connections, tissue, real sinew connections between themselves and the character that they're playing. So that inward responsibility to the work that you're going to do and to be as truthful and as brave as you can be is, I guess, paramount. And it's your responsibility to the work, to your colleagues, and to the audience who are giving of their time to come and see something real and truthful and moving. And then if you're not prepared to offer them something in exchange, then that diminishes that exchange between the stage and the audience. What do you reckon, Jolyon?
I think my view is a little bit more pragmatic in a way. I think my understanding of the responsibility of actors came, ironically, when I haven't acted, more when I've been teaching young people. And I think there's a preconception about acting, particularly when you're working with young actors, that it's this, you know, television's full of beautiful young people who ultimately just play themselves or film or whatever. And acting is really hard work. And in a lot of the jobs that I've done, they're long-term, big musicals, 8 times a week. You've got to front up, you've got to be present, and you've got to convince the audience every single night that you're experiencing that story for the first time. So for me, the responsibility of the actor is to be able to do that, to be able to lie more, actually, I think, and present that lie as truth for an audience who's spent a lot of money and time and organised babysitters and done all sorts of things to come out on that night. And to kind of bust that myth that it's something that, you know, the muse may descend upon you on stage maybe once or twice in a season or in your career where you suddenly feel, as an artist, you just disappear. But the rest of the time, you've got to work hard to make it look like that's happening all the time.
I guess that's a very good point. And it's almost an inverse way of saying the same thing. Well, our responsibility telling the story and serving the story for the people who have come out to see it. And sometimes it's going to feel transcendent and you're going to be, but it's not about
it's rarely transcendent. It should be transcendent, hopefully, for an audience,
but it's work and you have to do that work, right? Is it?
But I also find that in those moments where it has been transcendent, that often it's not your best work either. Mm. You know, you might come off the stage and go, I don't know what happened. The time disappeared. I lost myself. Mm. And the other actors are going, what the hell were you doing out there? You were just completely chaotic and we weren't hitting the mark and all that kind of stuff. So
you were having a wonderful time in you, which possibly meant that you weren't listening to what was going on around you.
And I think it's dangerous. So, you know, contrary to popular belief, acting, like all art forms, is an art form, and it's something that develops over time, that you should get better at it, and it's a skill that you should be able to replicate. And, you know, the
and
classic,
it is technical.
It's very technical.
I think where you're tending with that is a really, really important point, because sometimes people can imagine that, yeah, it is just
it's very ethereal.
Descending and that there is real technique and technical component to keeping yourself healthy. Oh, we have to say this at Monash all the time when, you know, and as you would know, Fleur, you've been a student there. Jolyon's currently with a group out there, and you have to tell them it's kind of revelatory for young people to go, you know, what you do on a Saturday night or a Sunday night when you've got a rehearsal on Monday morning, it impinges, and it's sort of what you do on a Sunday night suddenly belongs to us now a little bit, you know, your colleagues.
Yeah.
And they, you know, completely taken aback by this idea because, you know, they're imagining that their responsibility starts at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning.
Do you guys have an ethical code? Are there roles that you wouldn't do?
Oh,
ads that you wouldn't take, for example?
Wouldn't do a cigarette ad.
Yeah?
Yeah. There are other things like that. How I participate in the art, contributing to the greater good of society, I think, that as I grow older, I'm very much more conscious of. I think the way that I would allow my body to be used in film and TV, I'm a bit too old and cynical now to be given lines about how it's going to be lit really artistically and it's, you know, and all that rubbish, when you know that people can be very disposable with and just not particularly thoughtful about how they treat young women in those situations. It just completely confirms a whole lot of very nasty ways of looking at women. Just kind of repeats a whole lot of really nasty and demeaning discourses, and I wouldn't want to be part of that. So,
for me, it's less about the content, because in Australia, you know, we talk about jobs, we talk less about careers, I think, and we're so happy as actors when we've got jobs, and whether it's a job we like is kind of the icing on the cake, and, you know, often that doesn't happen, you know. But my ethical code, I suppose, for an actor is more about seeing the erosion of our rights and our pay and things like that. I've turned down a lot of jobs that I thought producers were potentially taking advantage of actors or demeaning somehow the skill set that I've developed over many, many years. And so that's my personal code. I mean, I'm sure there are things that I probably wouldn't do. I've not come across them.
You haven't been put to the test
yet. Yeah, I haven't really come across them. And again, I'm at heart a pragmatist, and to have a career in Australia means that you do all sorts of things that you don't. You know, it is less about an extreme thing that I wouldn't do, but there's plenty of television that I've done that I wouldn't watch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you bring up an interesting thing, I think, particularly, Sonia, touching on what you will let happen to your body. I want to bring up, recently there was a production in New Zealand of Declan Greene's 8 GB of hardcore pornography, where the ending of the play was changed because the actor decided not to get naked, which is a really interesting thing, because on one hand it's really tough for the playwright to get a message a week out of opening saying, by the way, we've changed the ending, is that okay? And the playwright's like, well, no. And I mean, he's also a very understanding guy. When he heard that it was because the actor decided they weren't comfortable, he's like, I don't want to be the guy that yells, get your clothes off or else. Sure. Like, sure. Who wants to be that person? But it is a
It's a tricky issue, right? Because you could make the argument, I'm sure, that, well, you read the script when you signed up to the role. And I guess it's about how safe you feel in the rehearsal space and with the people that you're working with. And it doesn't always stay the same when you take up a work and you're entering in these very complex contracts between, you know, actors and directors, and there's all sorts of unspoken dimensions to those contracts. And the idea that, oh, you, well, I signed up for it at the beginning, you're also imagining that this relationship is going to be fluid and safe, and sometimes you get into rehearsal spaces and they're not, and that you feel it's very didactic and you feel you have no voice. You don't feel very comfortable. It might take an actor weeks to feel, I can say to this director that I'm not feeling supported in the way that you told me I was going to be supported when I do this, and I am suddenly not comfortable with this. I can imagine how somebody could come to that. And then, of course, then the playwright's notified at week whatever, before it opens. I mean, I don't know this particular scenario. I'm just sort of imaginatively exploring why it might come to that instead of you read the script, why did you sign on, you know? It's not always as black and white as that.
Absolutely, and it's a very interesting thing. I wrote about On Stage Nudity about 6 months ago, and Jay Montgomery Griffith, who's done an awful lot of it, said reading that she realised how little she'd read about that vulnerability before, because I think there is an expectation in Australia that this stuff gets ironed out in the contract stages, and then from then on, whatever the actor has signed
is their responsibility to deliver. And that can be, I mean, you can make parallels around the issue of consent. I mean, you can't just say because you signed up to it at the beginning of the evening. You know, it has to be a consensual space.
I mean, if it's integral to the play, and clearly it is to that play, I think, you know, you would address if the actor is suddenly not feeling safe within the rehearsal room, and that is a really important thing. I think that's the thing to address first. Yes. And if that wasn't able to be resolved, maybe then changing the ending or maybe looking at recasting or whatever. Yeah. But I think it is dependent on the piece, and you know, that could significantly change the work and sound like it did it.
But I think that's exactly right. It's about the workspace being safe and that being able to be a dialogue. And these spaces can be very hierarchical, you know, and actors are encouraged. There's a sort of thing that happens to actors as a species, I think, because of the scarcity of work and whatnot. We become kind of skittish and all sorts of things, I think, that impact on our psychological makeup. You can be very fickle little beasts and genuinely afraid to arc up and speak from a position of, well, actually, I've done this for a number of years. I have things to offer. I'm not just a meat prop. I can contribute in this space with all of my faculties, my literary faculties, all of the things that have brought me to this point artistically and aesthetically. I would like to be part of that dialogue. And there are people who are open to that and creating those spaces, and then there are people who are a little bit more cut and dry, you know. And so I think you're right, the issue of addressing and making sure the rehearsal room is a safe space and not pretending that when you close off the doors and you're in a creative space that all of the things that operate in the real world doesn't infiltrate that room and are operating in a rehearsal room. I think there's this mythology that in creative industries, when we close the doors and turn the lights out and make art, that, you know, that people don't come in there with their whole psychological background, the interpersonal that we all have between us and in day-to-day life, in the outside world that operate in a creative space. And we, as directors and producers, need to be sensible to that, alive to that, and responsive to that.
Look, it would take a lot for me. If I'd signed on to that, knowing that that was required of me, it would be a very significant scenario that would ultimately say I couldn't do it. And I would feel responsible as an actor to deliver that and with that knowledge. And if there were other obstacles in the way, I would address those obstacles. But, yeah, I think we do have a responsibility to serve the play in that way. But you're right, we're not puppets. And there is a conversation, there's a dynamic that goes on between directors and other actors and stuff that needs to be respected as well.
Yeah, I might just read a little bit of this. I'll quote myself. Artists work in a highly charged environment. Our workplaces are more complicated than other people's and require a level of vulnerability that most people never reach in their day-to-day lives. There is never going to be a time when the bank teller will be asked to push his co-worker up against a wall and close his hands around her throat. The retail worker will not need to put her hands in her co-worker's pants. The barista will not be spat on. The political lobbyist won't have to simulate his own. Won't have to simulate his own suicide. The carpenter can safely assume that she won't be pinned down by three colleagues today. Bearing in mind that our world is one built on vulnerability. Vulnerability, I think, is the superpower of the artist, but is also what makes our workplaces so fraught. What do you think the responsibility is of the director towards the cast of actors in working in those incredibly complex...
That's much easier, I think, to address it. Like, for me, ultimately, the role of the director is to create a space that is open and creative and serves the work and is safe, ultimately. And if you have a group of artists who are cast correctly and understand the work that you're creating, your work is nearly done. That's 80% of the job, I think. So I think your role as a director is actually to create that beautiful, safe environment for the work to take place within. So if you succeed in that, I think then you're unlikely to have those kind of difficulties.
Exactly. Jolene's absolutely right in saying that there is so much at stake for actors in gigs that would mean that they would... I'm the same. It would take quite a lot for me. Actually, probably less now that I'm older and crankier. But when I was younger and keener, it would take a hell of a lot for me to put my hand up and say, I don't feel safe. So the first responsibility needs to be creating that space where artists do feel safe. Then you kind of erased most of the issues. And then if there are issues that crop up, then somebody feels like they're not going to get their head taken off, you know, saying so.
I think a really crucial and important part in ensuring that people feel safe comes in casting, as you sort of touched on then. Mm-hmm. I know when we were casting The City They Burned, we were acutely aware we're casting an ensemble that have to look after each other. They have to do nasty things to each other, but they also have to be there to support each other when working interactively with an audience. So you need a group that is going to so be there for each other and support each other. And I think that is a really good way to do a lot of the work for yourself in advance, in a way, is to get the right people for sensitive material. But I think that this thing that we've sort of mentioned about duty of care is what it comes down to.
It really does.
And actors are so conditioned to say yes.
And yes, let's. How we build scenes as improvisers. It's how we build, well, I think of them as a series of gigs, but let's call them careers for the sake of, you know, for the sake of it, is to play yes, let's all the time. And sometimes we don't feel empowered to say, oh, no, you might think from the outside that this is okay and... But it really isn't for me. It's kicking up some things for me. I'm a person with a background in psychology and I need to say no, not this. In certain circumstances. I had a wonderful story told to me in the foyer because we get it, the work that we did at the Neon Festival touched on a lot of this stuff and we worked out that in the development we could spend literally weeks talking about experiences that we'd shared as women and as actors in around this stuff. And then, of course, the work kicked off for a lot of women. Oh my God, yes, that happened to me. And oh my God, can I tell you about this? And one of them was telling me about an audition she went to recently and I wasn't at this audition. So, I mean, you know, I've got this story secondhand. But it sounded like a reality TV joke, basically, where the audition was, they were essentially told, the men were told just to hit the women. That was the instruction, hit the women. And then the second instruction was, don't hold back just because she's a woman. Told pretty reliably by someone who genuinely, when telling the story, actually used that reality TV language. Oh, and I got to the top two. I thought, oh my God, it would be funny if it wasn't nightmarish, that she had to say to her partner, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to do a stage hit, but for God's sake, please don't slap my face with an open palm. She had to take care of herself in that scenario, and the person wandered around going, you can stay, and pointing and saying, you can go, yes, thank you, you can go. And that's how they chose to audition people for. She was telling me it was a great role in a great play, but I was thinking, is it, though? If that's the way they're going to approach the material, is it a great role in a great play, or is this person just... getting their rocks off, getting two human beings to do that under the guise of creativity, you know, with absolutely none of what Jolene's speaking of. You know, we're kind of lucky, I guess, that sometimes you don't even conceive of that as an approach because your approach is so different. But
I did experience it. I was bullied in one of my first professional gigs out of Whopper on a production, which was a horrific experience actually, with a theatre company here. We had a director who'd come from overseas. I was given to him in the cast. He didn't get to cast me, and I became a whipping boy. Mm. And it was really awful, awful scenario that I vow would never happen again. But it just works against you as well, because ultimately I completely shut down. I wasn't able to give him anything that he wanted by then. And I was resentful and angry and upset. And his production suffered for that reason.
Absolutely.
And going, well, it just was crazy.
I think everybody's had something, if not that extreme one that I described, the experience of being shut down in a rehearsal room. And as an actor, what happens is that you start to second guess, I'm offering this, I'm offering that, I'm offering this, nothing I'm offering is right. Then you start to kind of, well, I have, at least my experience aligned to that was then to kind of feel completely inadequate and just constantly second guessing, and so that nothing I put forth was,
specifically singled out in a note session horribly. And the group of actors also were stony silent, including a whole lot of very well-respected actors who had been in the industry, particularly one who'd been the head of Whopper when I was there as well, I was working with. And, everyone was terrified to speak up. They knew it was inappropriate and knew it was wrong. And, but it's just such a ridiculous thing to think you can do that and then get work out of people. But on the other flip side, we were talking about responsibility. It reminded me of my first television gig, which was hilarious, on Water Rats. I was cast as the baddie murderer who killed someone and stashed them in the harbour or did something. And I just came out of Whopper and I was so keen to do everything right. I'd worked so hard, and part of it was this fight sequence with a certain actor who was the lead in the show. And I rehearsed it with a fight choreographer, did everything perfectly. It was this amazing thing. I was really proud of myself. But, of course, he didn't rehearse it and fronted up to the scene. And we started to do the fight sequence, of which I was doing half of. He was meant to block this blow with a metal bar, this fake metal bar that I had, which he didn't. I hit him straight in the head, cut his head open, and shut down production for 2 hours because the continuity of this massive big cut him. It was just awful. But I thought, I'll never work again. But the responsibility for him was to be across that stuff, and he wasn't, and that's what happened.
Hit on the head. Well, and he'll learn.
Yeah, it was just awful. It was terrible, terrible, terrible scenario. But it actually broke in half. This metal bar ricocheted into his head.
Oh my god! So, and I can imagine that feeling of like, I'll never work again.
This really conchy actor just sitting, kind of bubbling, on the edge of this boat in the middle of the harbour somewhere.
Oh god! I've witnessed actors kind of go into moral panics when they've double booked themselves, because this thing I was talking about the psychology of the actors, that sort of scarcity logic.
Wanting to do everything
at once, and you might be having a year where 40 weeks you're out of work, and then there's 12 weeks where all the work comes in, and you just don't feel like you can say no to it. And sometimes you actually have to choose and take that responsibility and not push that onto production teams. I was on a set once with, a guy very fresh out of drama school who had basically double booked himself for a gig in Melbourne and a show that was opening in Sydney, because he thought, I'll do a day shoot and then I'll catch the plane and to Sydney and open the show. And anyone who's done any shoot will know it never runs on time. And they're not going to care. You haven't put a restriction in via your agent because he didn't want to rock the boat. He just thought he'll manage it by himself. And once you're on set, too bad, buddy, you're on set. And he was watching him watch the clock down, working out, I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to be there. And it was so panic-inducing just to be next to him. Being an adult sometimes, I think, is something I'd like to say to actors, like when I'm having to produce, don't make me to be mum and tell you, no, you have to choose between, you have to choose between these two mutually exclusive gigs. Now, what are you choosing?
I was told a story where I lived in London for a couple of years by an actor who was understudying a very famous actor who never went off. And he thought, he's never going to go off, and hadn't learnt the show. And then got the call one evening to say, you're on, and had this total meltdown, went in to try and learn it, hadn't learned it, and decided to move to France because of it. Had left the theatre, was going to catch the Eurostar and live in France. Just go, just to disappear,
just like in
because
witness protection.
Of the horror of that and letting everyone down. God. And bumped into the actor on the way there.
With his bags.
And said, oh, no, I decided I'd be fine. I'm coming in. And just, had he not bumped into him, he would have been living in France with probably surgery and all sorts of changes. But it is, the stakes are that high, you know.
Honestly.
When you talk about responsibility, yes. That's, you know, is
and
immense.
And I have nightmares like that. I have nightmares that there was a rehearsal, like that nightmare you had in school where everyone was doing, like, Mandarin lessons on the side and, because all the tests were going to be given in Mandarin in your year 12, and I'm the only one who didn't know that, and I didn't do the Wednesday afternoon Mandarin class. Like, I have them in theatre as well, where everybody's been rehearsing this dance sequence that, you know, that I'm supposed to know, and we're, you know, so I think, yeah, the stakes are massively high.
Yeah, we really put those stakes on ourselves.
I want to go back to We Get It, because it was such a fascinating play and opened up so much about theatre and about acting and about being a woman in theatre and all of that stuff. And there was one particular monologue that you shared with Kesha, but it was about drama school and about
That idea that we talked about just before, about, you know, you close off the lights and turn the music up loud and now we're in some sort of alternate universe where people don't have a responsibility to each other beyond pushing their imagination and around what their character needs.
Yeah, their responsibility is to themselves. No rules.
There are no rules. Of course there are rules. Like, of course the dynamics of society feed in and through these porous walls and through ourselves. And of course you have, as in everywhere in life, you have responsibility to those around you. Mm. So in this monologue, and it's shared, and it was deliberately shared because it's not a sole experience. Every woman I've spoken to has a version of this experience, was about this person being told that they had to, you know, do these kind of long form improvisations in a dark room with loud music, and that the character playing her husband continuously at the climax of these improvisations mimicked rape on her person over and over and over and over and over again. And she would come away from this bruised and go home with the experience of physically and psychologically having a non-consensual act performed on her. And when she dared to raise her hand to the director, she was told that she needed to protect herself better and that everyone has to do what they need to do to explore their characters. And so the rights of the rapist in that scenario were much more privileged over her rights as a person experiencing that. And the power of that monologue is that it mirrors real life. And the whole play was like that. It was using the lens of an actress or actresses to talk about gender issues more broadly, you know. Mm. And so there's a very similar idea there when we talk about rape and rape culture, that there's something that you can do to prevent, you know, people taking violent charge of your person. You know, if you walk a certain way or if you don't dress a certain way, you know, that somehow you can prevent that, and that's your responsibility to do that, you know.
Yeah. I had a really interesting thought while watching that where I went, oh, other people in this room that haven't gone through drama school must probably think this is an exaggeration or a one-off. Like, I sort of found myself looking around being like, do you guys think this is made up, because it's so familiar? And I haven't gone through drama school actor training, but just like seeing actors come out haggard
from
sessions. And then it also made me think of talking to a male actor who came through VCA, and I sort of at the end of his training, I said, like, how did you find it? And he went, oh, I really struggled. I went in knowing I was really good at physical stuff. You know, I trained as a dancer and a gymnast, and I thought, I've got these movement classes down. And then I discovered that being good at movement as a male in actor training meant being good at picking up and moving around and pinning up against walls women. And that wasn't him. And so he then just kind of shut down a movement for 3 years. And that was a really interesting thought, to think actor training and physical training of actors is perhaps at times at its worst and most extreme is training women to be victimized and men to be victimizers.
Yeah, there's a consciousness that needs to be put around the way that we behave and not just keep patting ourselves on the back or excusing, well, we're creating art, so it's not real. it is actually also happening to somebody. And like I had a play that I was involved in that was a really well-meaning play where we were all wanting to, it was with members of community, so it was a kind of community theatre with some professional actors involved, and it was exploring prostitution from a number of different angles, and women who had been trafficked and women who were working in the sex industry and what that did and does to their person. And there was a trafficked woman who consented to be part of this play, and there was a rehearsal where the director and I had been playing this particular plot before, and then she wanted to put this girl into the plot, and the director had said, okay, what you're going to do now is you're going to walk over there and an actor, let's call him John is going to force you onto your knees and simulate oral sex.
Was this you or the
this
trafficked?
Was the woman who'd been trafficked. And poor old John was looking at, you know, around going, oh, really? That's what we're going to do now? She's not an actor. She's not a professional. She's actually lived an experience. She's been shackled to bed. She's lived. This is her. This is trauma. And we're just going to push her through it again just to elicit a response from the audience, because it makes us all feel good about ourselves that we know that we're doing really meaningful art. And I kind of lost it from the sideline. I mean, this is why I'm sort of older and crankier now, because I was like, no, I don't think we should do that. But it was one of those things where it was like a nightmare was happening in real time, and she was kind of going over to John and then he was pushing her down in the way that we do in actor training, was like the woman would lead that moment, and there's an illusion that the man is pushing her down and pulling it on her hair, but she's actually driving it. And of course she just collapsed into tears, because it was physiologically she was going through the same thing. And the director gave her big cuddles and strokes and felt, you know, like she was, you know, there was some sort of catharsis going on, and I just wanted to, I had little aneurysms in my head going, you know, this is not okay. And the responsibility is not to re-traumatise this woman in the name of art, you know. Mm. So it really happens. This stuff happens,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, it sounds like there's big question marks about her being in that position in the first place.
Yeah, she works though. She works a lot, and you know, and people came at to the end of the play, and they all felt the feelings, and they gave her big hugs and told her what. And I was labelled a bit of a crank on that show, because I was constantly on the sidelines going, "It's not ethical. It's not ethical." Like, you know, and
sometimes someone needs to be the crank.
Yeah, I just thought it was. Yeah, with there's
well,
no consciousness.
It's funny. My wife works in emergency medicine, and we often have the talk in, you know, at the end of the day about our days and what we've done, and you know, the stuff she experiences on a daily basis, particularly in the current environment of ICE and mental illness and stuff. And she's right on the cutting edge of that, and it's full on. But there are very strict protocols about how to deal with these things. There are very strict guidelines, all sorts of stuff, and because it's incredibly important. But we don't have the equivalent in our industry, because I think, like you're saying, you know, it's about expressing yourself. It's about creativity. Yeah. It's about getting in there and then...
There are no rules.
Yeah.
There are rules.
And there are. And there certainly are rules. Yeah.
So another issue that we get it really talked about was this thing of being a woman of colour as an actor. Mm-hmm. And you've also talked to me in the past about how many Muslim doctors you've played.
I know.
And it's a really interesting thing, because I remember at the start of the year I was working on a series of readings, and there was an Indigenous man in that, and he got to play a doctor. And I remember at the end of the reading, you know, in the sort of Q&A at the end, he said, "I just want to say thank you for casting me as a doctor. I never get to play the doctor."
Yeah.
And then to hear you say, "I'm always playing the
bloody doctor." Once on the plane, it was like they said, "Is there a doctor on the plane?" And I almost got up. And I thought, what are you going to do when you get there, you fool? Like, you're not a doctor.
Yeah.
I have to say very quickly, last week I took my son, who's 4, to see the doctor.
Yeah.
And he turned to me and said, "Daddy, men can be doctors too."
Oh, that's awesome.
I was so proud. I went, yes.
Yes, they can,
I've
son.
I've done my job.
Yeah, good work.
That's very impressive. But Sonia, what do you think the responsibility of the casting director is when it comes to diversity?
Look, I had one of the casting directors who'd cast me as a Muslim doctor come up and say, "I'm sorry, I realised I was one of those people," but it was actually my favourite Muslim medical role. So I was like, no, that was fine. That one was great. I think it's being really aware of the racial dramaturgy that we see around us on our screens and stages, because there's that adage about the easiest way to make monsters of people is not to offer them a mirror. you know. And if using the, what do we call it, that we constantly kick up in the arts, but, you know, we hold a mirror up to ourselves, that's what we're doing in the arts. If we use that idea, but the mirror is only reflecting certain people, that these people are the heroes in the stories, that they have stories, they own the stories, and we only exist, we being women, me being people of colour, whatever it is, able-bodied people, transgender people, whoever we are, only exist on the sideline of those narratives. We're not the people who have one of our own. You don't have your fullest expression of your humanity on offer for you to read yourself in the arts, and I think that's really dangerous. You know, there's all sorts of studies, and Jolyon makes spectacular works that are accessible to children. There's all sorts of really interesting studies around what children get to see, and if they don't see themselves in, like, cartoons and programs that are made for young people, if they're not white and male, they can actually get depressed after watching, or just feel that self-confidence is eroded after watching narratives where they're not the hero. They identify as not a person who has as much agency, you know? And that's, I think, an incredible idea that that can be coded so subliminally. But of course we know that, because by the time we become adults, we see the impact of all that coding. You can identify as other to the mainstream. And the most, I suppose, in our contemporary culture, the most extreme expression of that is when people who are grown up in a culture and have been at all points excluded from the narrative and the dominant narrative will latch on to other narratives about identity. What happens when people who are here and grow up here, born here, educated here, go, you know what, I need to claim an identity with a foreign terrorist group? What is that? What's happening? What's at play there? Because they've been excluded from the narratives all the way along, and we've not let in the sandpit to play and have this fullest expression of their humanity here. And there's somebody offering some easy catch-all, grab at this and let that be your identity off really far left of field. And that's obviously what's happening. And so it is dangerous not to let everybody have a crack on our, our screens and stages and make a meaningful multicultural society and reflect it back at ourselves.
When we were talking about this at the beginning of the year, and tell me if this is an example you don't want me to use.
No, go on.
But we talked about a particular story that was put on stage, but the story was taken from a thing that actually happened, and it was a young Indian woman, and then when it went on stage...
It's a number of years ago, and look, I mean, I don't know, it's difficult to talk about what's happening in a rehearsal room when you weren't involved in the process, and there were some really amazing people that I respect who were involved in that particular play. But let's say, you know, there are so few characters written for Indian women, you know, at all. And there's a couple of different things at stake. I guess one is that the white body in our racial dramaturgy is the transformative body. So when it suits our purposes, we can say, oh, but, you know, race is irrelevant. Like, why can't someone who's, you know, I don't know, Eastern European play this role? Well, okay, they can, but there's just so few roles written for people of this specific ethnicity, be it Indian, be it Vietnamese or Indigenous. There's so few roles. Why take one off the table when it's been written onto our stage? Why take that complex, wonderful role where it's the character is not a Muslim doctor and there's a wonderful arc for a character of colour, and why take it off the stage by using the argument in inverse? Oh, well, you know, if we're all about cross-racial casting, that role's on the table for white people. All of the roles are on the table for white people. Let's, you know, so it is a complex thing to kind of try and package up. But I guess it's about making space on our stages for people of colour and making those spaces interesting.
It's a really interesting phrase to talk about, though, the transformative body, whose body is allowed to be transformative within the context of art. Who's allowed to be neutral, I guess, is the easier way of saying it. And there's been a lot of examples. Noah, you know, quite famously, the casting director came out with a horrific statement about that, being like, we didn't want race to be an issue, so we just made everyone white.
Because that's,
you know.
Well, you sort of avoid the issue there, yeah. Did you?
Yeah, and then also currently.
Didn't want it to be an issue for white people.
Yeah. But also at the moment, Death and the Maiden is on at MTC, and I haven't seen it because I knew I'd just go in really grumpy, because I'm grumpy about this without having seen it. But that's like one of the plays that probably more than any other play in the canon speaks to the history of Chile in the 20th century, and all the posters are of this Anglo blonde woman. That's like you've and got someone worried. Telling the national story of Chile in the 20th century.
If you're a South American actress having to play, you know, Conchita all the time,
yeah,
you would be like, this is it, this is my, you know, and you've sort of been erased. And I guess that's the thing. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy with casting directors and directors. Like, oh, there aren't that many. There aren't that many out there, you know, really good Indigenous actors, really good Asian actors. Well, if you've come from drama school, let's look at person A who's blonde and blue-eyed and person B who's not, let's say. And person A is able to refine and continue to mature in their craft because of the vast array of roles that they're allowed to play as a transformative body. And yes, yeah. everyone is prescribed by their body to some, you know, extent. I'm not insensible to that fact. But that person 10 years later will be, by default, a better actor than someone who is just, you know, playing token ethnic roles or, you know, token whatever roles, little grabs, never held a lead. No, you've not given the same opportunity to mature in your craft. Mm-hmm. And then you get directors going, yeah, but I can't find any here. You know, there just aren't any.
Yeah.
Like, really? Because every time I go to a casting, yeah. Well, I'm surrounded by them.
We had a very interesting thing with The City They Burned because that was a big cast. It was a cast of 9. And I said to the director, like, I'm recording this, I'm writing about this. If we end up with a cast of 9 white people, we're in trouble. Like, we can't do this. And then we had, you know, 210 people auditioned, and I think maybe 2 people of colour who just weren't right in terms of age bracket. And I was like, oh, God. And then the next week, the same theatre company held auditions for a play that was based on the story of Norman Ahmed. And we went, oh, there they all are. They just didn't know that they were allowed. Invited to our audition because we didn't say we're looking for a diverse range of actors. And so we took some of the actors from that audition. But that was a fascinating wake-up call to be like, you have to actually say, like, guys, we want you.
It's such a complex issue because it's a conversation that happens regularly, particularly at Arena. And I don't think it comes down to a lack of desire from directors and from casting agents. It's a really complex set of circumstances. And at the Australian Theatre Forum this year, I thought Richard Franklin spoke about cultural loading more eloquently than I've ever understood it really before in my life. And just the most extraordinary illustration of, you know, an Indigenous actor fronting up at your rehearsal room and saying, this is what they're carrying. Mm. And it just gives me goosebumps to even think about it now. And look, you know, we were a group of lefty, you know, all sitting there going, yeah, we're willing. And I don't think I ever understood it better than that day. I think there's an element where people are frightened to know what the protocols are. We don't want to get it wrong. There's a complex set of circumstances within those particular communities that you're dealing with as well. And so I think, and I'm optimistic, I think the desire is very strongly there, and particularly notions of colourblind casting and all that kind of stuff. But we've got a little way to go for it to be a given. But I think those conversations are certainly happening.
I agree.
Much more than they were.
I reckon in the last 10 years, that's been, I mean, at least from my perspective on it, it seems that that's been on the agenda in a way that, you know, it wasn't as conscious or articulate before, you know. Yeah.
I want to move us on to talking a little bit about your work with children, Joel, because that's now a really big part of what you do.
Absolutely,
And I was rereading again today the vision statement of Arena, which is just one of the most beautiful documents.
It really is.
It's just gorgeous.
Pretty sort special of, place, actually.
Yeah, I've got a little bit of it here. I might just find. Our artistic vision is founded on the belief that theatre creates a space that is surprising, alive, fertile, explosive, dangerous and inspiring, which I think is just a beautiful thing to bear in mind when working with children. I'll read on, actually. We believe that theatre for young people has intrinsic value, not merely as preparation for adulthood, a form of education or marginalised version of theatre for adults. It investigates and celebrates the experience of young people in the here and now. If you could speak to what the responsibilities are around creating work for children. I love that you've got the word dangerous in a vision statement about creating work for children, but how do you be dangerous whilst looking after audiences as young as 4 and 5?
Yeah, well, that's a really fantastic question. There's all sorts of ways of working with kids that I just find fascinating. We just come off doing an extended residency for a term in a school in Melton with a really interesting group of kids, lower socioeconomic kids and really diverse backgrounds. And the way in which you can kind of get into their worlds and understand what they're dealing with, it was a phenomenal experience. One of the things Christian Leasley, our AD, talks about a lot is that the worst people to ask about what kind of work they want are young people, when you're making work for young people. But the best thing you can do is find out how they think and what they do. So ARENA is very strong about engaging with our audience at all times, involving them in workshops and in developments and kind of with a radar to working out how they think and what they're interested in. Danger is a great word. Kids can appropriate all sorts of activities and items and anything and put them all into one thing, and for those things to cohabit beautifully. Actual danger, oh, I don't know really how to speak to danger. I'm thinking of a most recent work, Marlon, which was a show investigating some pretty extraordinary, pretty full-on issues for young people.
Could you perhaps explain a bit about the Marlon Expedition as well? Because I think that's a really unique...
Okay, the Marlon Expedition is a really interesting example of one of the works that we did. It's a little adjunct show that we did to our main stage show, which was called Marlon. We wanted to kind of investigate the main stage show more deeply, so we decided to put our audience on a small boat in the Yarra and give them a theatrical experience with an actor and a really intense experience. So if we're talking about danger, they literally are in a boat on the river and dealing with an actor. Actually, it was actually very rigorously put together so that they were very safe, actually.
But they feel that they are the ones looking for the fish.
Absolutely. You know? So the premise of that little piece was that there was a marlin. It needed to be taken to deep water to be released, and they were given a task to fulfill that. So they were put on a boat, they had a task and they had an actor, and they were told that they had to save this fish. Along the way, other things are revealed. They get to release this fish, but it also turns out that the actor who is taking them through this narrative has died, and he's a ghost. He sings a song to them under the bridge about missing his daughter, who is actually the lead in the main stage show that we had on at the MTC. In terms of notions of theatre, kids have so little baggage about what theatre is. We have enormous license to kind of go anywhere we like, and so putting kids on a boat to give them a show really didn't faze them at all. But it's such an extraordinary way. All their senses are alive. They're open to all sorts of different ways, and the story gets in much deeper ways. It was a beautiful experience. And the line between what is real and what is not was very, very fine for that particular
piece.
It
really must make the city magical for them in that moment.
My friend was that person on the boat, one of my friends from drama school, and he did film McGuinness describes children towards the end of that show kind of leaning forward to touch him to see if he was real or a real ghost.
And the other thing, I mean, we didn't have a fish. So many children came back and actually saw this fish being released and leaving, and they saw it splash in the water. It was extraordinary. It was a magical piece. And so ARENA really loves to kind of explore that territory where theatre is taken out of that traditional form and put in a different environment. And, there's a study Melbourne Uni just did on that particular piece as well, which is coming out soon, which is going to be very illuminating, I think, in terms of kids' experience.
Hands down, some of the most incredible theatrical experiences I've seen as an adult have been ARENA Theatre, because I think the other thing that's really wonderful about their mission statement is they talk about it as being work that's accessible to children. It's not patronising in that, in its pedagogy, I suppose. Like, it's not for them. It includes them. But, my God, as an adult, my husband and I came out, we took Daniel, our son who's now 5, when he was supposedly way too young for it, but we took him to the House of Dreaming. Again with Phil and Kath, and it was wonderful. We came out with tears in our eyes. We were like, this is what theatre is, you know. It was just immersive and spectacular and wonderful.
I feel very lucky, because we often talk about not patronising our audience, but ultimately that's a lie. We just make really great art. We have great fun, and it just happens to be for an audience for young people.
There's so much more we could say. I mean, and that's partly because you two are both such fascinating, multifaceted artists, but also, I guess, the topic of responsibility. Sitting here listening, I'm like, oh, we could do a whole hour just on children's theatre. We could do a whole hour on casting and diversity and all of that. Each of these things sort of have opened up something so meaty and worthy of more than a 10-minute slot. But we're also working to parent time as Sonia's husband is downstairs
with said Daniel and
a 12-week-old baby. So we'd better wrap up and let you guys finish. But thank you so much. Our guests today have been Sonia Suarez and Jolien James. We'll continue to explore the question of responsibility in the next episode. You can find us on iTunes and through our website, audiostage.gorillasemiotics.com.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Cheers, Luke. Flair, can I do a shout out for my show?
Yes, you can.
How will I do it? I don't know how to. I'm just going to shout it out.
Just do it.
So we do wonderful work at Watch This as well. And we've got a show coming up in September, October called Company with a wonderful, diverse electric cast of people doing some
amazing cast.
Yeah, it's a good cast. Come fantastic. To it. It's at 45 Downstairs and opens on the 17th of September.
And Joel, do you have anything you want to shout out to?
Oh, no, nothing. We've always got stuff going on.
Yeah.
Go see arena shows.
Yeah, anything to do with arena, come along and see it. But thank you. It's been such a pleasure.